Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob Podcast with These Football Times for another journey into the centre circle with me, Aidan Williams, today to chat about another intriguing football book with an author very well known to us at These Football Times and with a subject that I think will be a really interesting perspective on the game we all love. But before we get to the author and his book, though, firstly, joining me today are two of our gang of usual suspects. We've got our man in Spain who is in a very good mood right now because, as of the time we're recording, Chelsea have just beaten Man City about half an hour ago to get into the cup final and deny Man City any chance of a quadruple. Gary Thacker, welcome, Gary. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm quite happy at the moment. And who knows, he might be playing City again in the European Cup final in a few weeks if they get past PSG and we can climb over Real Madrid. But you never know. You never know. That's football, matey. And I'm delighted to be talking about a slightly different book to the top we normally talk about, but even more fascinating because of that.
Absolutely. Yes, indeed. It should be a fascinating one because there's slightly different perspective, and that's what we like here. So also with us today is Stephen Scragg. Hi there, Stephen.
How are we doing, Aidan? Looking forward to this. These particular book podcasts that we do when it's one of our own, it always feels a bit like, I don't know, almost like the stag do of the book. I think I could describe as one time. And this one's just a very special one.
Very much so. Well, okay. And then without further ado, let's introduce our guest for today's pod. He is, as the guys have mentioned there, a stalwart of These Football Times, having been writing for the site since not long after its conception, nigh on a decade or so ago. He'll be familiar to podcast listeners too as the host of the ever popular Coaches Forum series of podcasts, but today we're discussing his new book, It's Just a Ball, Exploring the Complexity of a Simple Game, with the ever excellent John Townsend. Hi there, John, how are you doing?
Hey guys, how are you?
Doing very, very well, and very keen to get into this book. It's a really intriguing look at a subject that we all love.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. It's an honor to be part of this, especially with those of you who have written books yourself and know the complexity and the frustration and the excitement of the process, but just in terms of just being able to chat with you guys on a Saturday. I appreciate you guys taking the time.
Oh, not at all. Our pleasure indeed. So let's get into the book then. You describe it as a bit of a personal exploration of the beautiful game. It's capturing all sorts of different aspects. But I guess to kick us off, you can sort of give us a general intro to the book as well. But also, what was it that inspired you to write this book? And especially for listeners who aren't aware, you've got quite a background in coaching, of course, as well as hosting the Coaches Forum podcast. You worked as a coach for some time. So is this book something that was inspired by those coaching experiences?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting story. I was searching for topics before I actually started formally writing about the game. I just wasn't seeing a lot that was written from the perspective of maybe somebody who's done it recently and maybe has a fresh, unique perspective. And so I wrote an article in 2014 about just the relationship a player has with the ball. And I shared a snippet of my life when I was living in the Netherlands about playing with a team there. And as an American, I was learning the game and I was at a different rate than some of the players there, but I was sharing a method that I had seen and then I kind of instilled into me anyway. And I thought about it years later. It's like, well, I was always doing that. It just wasn't as structured as it was in the Netherlands, as they tend to structure everything very, very cleverly. And I wrote an article that Omar, These Football Times He was working with QPR at the time. He shared it with Harry Redknapp, and it kind of took off in a way with coaches. It resonated with people who were working with players at the academy level and even at the professional level, and it spread like wildfire, very surprisingly. And then that got picked up by The Guardian, and then about a week later, somebody from London had called me and said, "Hey, I'm interested in this being a book." And I said, what makes this an interesting book topic?" And they said, "Well, it just is something that's never been written. It's something that we think has a lot of potential to be intriguing. Would you be interested in writing a book?" And I just said no, because I didn't expect it to be as well received or as popular. And at this time, as anyone who's written an article that's been well read, about a week or two later, the criticism starts coming in as well, and the refuting it and rebuttals. And so that was kind of the first time ever had been exposed to both sides of what an audience can do. So conversations took place, and I outlined a skeleton draft of what a book could be, based on a series of methods that connect between different countries, coaching methodologies, playing styles. And it all kind of came down to the unique experience of, the best players in the world, the best cultures in the world that love football, they treasure the ball. They value keeping possession of the ball, getting skill on the ball. That is a focal point of the game. I think sometimes in the complex world we live in, we overlook that. We look at stuff several levels above just a player and a ball. And so I started really doing a deep dive into different topics related to player and a ball. So that's kind of where I went through. But having a coaching background and a playing background, it kind of made an exciting project. But then I realized what goes into writing a book is not necessarily just sitting down in front of your computer. It's a lot more than that.
Well, we can all testify to that, certainly. I mean, yeah. this being your first book then, John, I mean, how did you find, you talk there about, it's a lot more than just sitting down at your computer. How did you find the process in terms of writing? Was it, you've written a huge number of articles and all that, but obviously, to expand that out to a book, it's a different ball game altogether, to coin a phrase, isn't it?
No, it absolutely is. And the thing about this is I do a lot of marathon running, and this is something that I really kept tethering myself to, is when you start a marathon, you get that idea of running one, you're excited for training, you're not injured, you're not tired, you have energy, there's optimism. And then as the race comes and you start to realize maybe I'm not as prepared as I need to be, but I'm at the line, and the first couple of miles of that race, it begins to, you have a swell of, momentum, and the ideas are fresh and things are great. And then you hit your obstacles and the course changes and the conditions change, and you start to realize, have I written myself into a corner here? Or am I still holding true to the purpose of what I thought it was going to be? And so it's a really iterative process. And I, people do laugh at this, but most of this book was not really written on my computer. It was written in 1,000 notes on my iPhone or on notebooks that I had locked away in my, filing cabinet or in my backpack or on an airplane traveling for work. It was just put together and pieced together when I had momentum to do something. And a lot of this book is nonfiction. So there's some case studies and interviews that I had to rely on. And in some of these case studies, what I found is I'm not a researcher. I'm not a movement sciences doctorate of any type. I'm just someone who's exploring this. And so I make it very clear in the book that, this is research that I've done and I've really poured a lot of myself into, but it's just a challenge to intrigue people to explore some of the connections that I was trying to make. And so I would say the process is iterative. Could be exhausting, exciting too. But I think when life and creativity collide, sometimes what you thought was a timeline can be quite complex. And so someone told me, who's written before, there is no such thing as a book that is ever finished. You're just finished writing it, is kind of how they said it. So, and I agree with that now, having completed the first one.
Oh, I like that way of putting it. That's good. And I'm sure the rest of the guys can attest to that. I mean, Gary, your thoughts there. You've written several books now, haven't you, going back over the last few years? How much of what John's saying there echoes with you?
I mean, I like the metaphor about it being a marathon, because, that's definitely what it is. And, I remember my first book, and your first marathon is a real killer. Your first book is very much the same thing. It's unknown territory that you're entering into. And, as John mentioned there, you get into the start of it, and you're thinking, what have I done here? what have I slept myself in for? And it's interesting to John was saying there about a lot of the book was written in notes and scribbled down in ideas he was travelling about. And yeah, that's all the same, man. I quite often do when I'm reading a book, a different book, you know, or some on an allied subject. I think, oh, yeah, that's a good point. You know, you make a little note of that. And yeah, I've probably lost 3/4 of the notes I ever scribbled down because they're either all in a pile in a little cabinet where I keep my my documents, or they're in pockets that have been washed in the washing machine and they've been disintegrated. But yeah, I think that's, you know, John's count of writing a book there certainly rings very true with me. And you know, especially when he said it's exhausting and exciting, and it is, it's both of those things and in equal measures, or varying sort of depths of equal measure. But you know, I we'll perhaps touch on this later, but you know, the thing about finishing your first book or stopping writing is, you know, when do you start your second one? That's the key, because you want to get into that marathon run again.
Indeed, we'll come on to that certainly. Stephen, coming to you on this, I mean, John's used a lot of his own experiences as like not just inspiration, but sort of through this book. And obviously, this applies to Gary as well, I guess, in terms of enjoying watching the great Dutch team of the past and so on. And yourself with your books, it's, you know, you hark back to watching Sports Night, don't you? And seeing the Cup Winners' Cup results and highlights coming through and things like that. So you bring in experiences into writing. I mean, do you think doing that, I mean, I guess that's the obvious way that we all get inspired, isn't it? But do you think it makes the writing process easier to have that base of personal experience, or perhaps to put it another way, does it lead to a more compelling read?
Possibly. I mean, I'm always of the mind that you've got to have a passion for the topic you take on. You know, I think that makes a big difference, because it can sustain you when you have those inevitable slowdowns, you know, because you will hit a wall every now and then when you're writing a book, and you've got to drag yourself out of ruts here and there, and there'll be periods. I mean, it is like running a marathon, but it's like running a marathon in short sprints. You know, you'll slow down, you'll speed up, and there'll be times when you're hitting it out of the ballpark completely, and then there'll be other times where you're struggling to put two or three paragraphs together. It's just the nature of writing, whether that's an article or whether that's a book, whatever it is. It's just the way it meanders along, and you know, the peaks and troughs and all of that. But yes, I fully believe that, you know, having some kind of passion for the topic, a connection to it. Because I mean, I know with the stuff that I write, I get a lot of people who'll come along and say, yes, you know, you wrote that exactly the way I feel about it, you know, and several people have come forward and said, it's like you've written that book for me, you know, and in a way that's great to hear. But, you know, I kind of wrote it for myself, you know, but it's great that, you know, you have that connection with people, that it's not just you that's felt that way about that topic and that's the way it comes across. But you need that kind of experience, that you know, that feel for the topic. And that can be, you know, it doesn't have to be something you've lived through necessarily. It could be something that you've just been drawn in by, you know, great history writers or write about the Roman Empire, and obviously they didn't live it, but they've loved it. You know, you've either got to to live something or love something to be able to put that topic across in that passionate style that will draw people in. I mean, I'm a great believer that, you know, passion and of thought and of speech and of writing is just such an evocative thing, no matter what that is. I was actually asked to do a Zoom chat with a primary school not so long ago, and yeah, about writing and book writing and publishing and all that. And I remember saying to them that, you know, it's not sometimes what you write, it can be how you write. You can really kind of draw a person in, even if it's not a topic that they think they would appreciate or like. I mean, I can remember not so long ago listening to an interview on, I think it was on Six Music one morning, and it was a woman who was talking about 1960s suspense thrillers, you know, those psychological thrillers that lead you up to the thoughts of what's happening, bit you know, Hitchcock type things, where they're not necessarily gratuitously violent in a visual way, they play on the mind. And I found that there's no way I would watch something like that, because it just doesn't speak to me. But the way she was speaking about it and the way she was passionate about it, you know, the whole 10-minute interview or whatever, just had me kind of, and I remember kind of like thinking, I'm meant to be going out now, but I want to hear the end of this interview. Despite the fact that it was a topic that really didn't kind of like, you know, talk to me. So yes, you know, that passion for a topic can really, really strike a chord, no matter what it is.
You know, just jump in for a second in there. I mean, you know, the books Stevie's written, the books I've written, we're writing as observers rather than sort of participants. And I think this is one of the main differences with John's book, because obviously coaching is something that he's massively involved in. So I just throw a question, John, if you don't mind, Aidan. I mean, do you think the book would have been different, John, if you hadn't have been as involved in coaching as you are?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a fair point. I think one of the things that when I first started writing about the game, it was because in my country especially, just saw a lack of authentic voices within the coaching sphere. Because everyone tries to sound and present themselves to be very, very in line with whatever the accepted methods are. And I always try to challenge things, not to be contrarian, but just say, well, this is what I experienced. This is what I'm seeing on the field. This is what the players are saying to me. This is what I remember being as a player. And this isn't being addressed, and I can't find any literature on it. So I might as well just start maybe creating some, and maybe somebody will, you know, help me along the way. And so I think when you look at the book, or even some of the articles that I write about podcasts that I do on the coaches forum, it's always with a player-centric perspective. So even as a coach, you try to look at things from a perspective of, although you're not playing anymore, there's still a way to affect development or the game or just players' attitudes that sometimes goes missing in many ways. So for instance, I hadn't ever written an article or read an article that talked about what something could potentially do to a whole culture or generation of players. And so the big theme here was, you know, when I was a kid in the Netherlands, one of the things that was stressed was you need to get 1,000 touches on the ball a day, and not just 1,000, right? For, you know, 2,000, 4,000, 10,000 possibly. And that's kind of the number that a lot of the players that I was training with, the host family that I was living with, they were all, you know, saying, I can do this in, you know, a course of a day. I can, you know, hit a ball against the wall 1,000 times. And it was very, you know, much about getting kids hung up on the number to get them to strive. And if they fell short, they were still hitting many, many game realistic touches. And so I wanted to write something that was from a coaching perspective, but also something that I firmly believed in and did as a player myself. And so one of the interesting parts about this book is when you write something you're passionate about, or you've done yourself, you sort of begin to be your own worst critic. You're like, well, is this going to be relevant for everybody, or was it just me? And you start to really, you need to get out of your own head sometimes. And I believe that one of the biggest influences of me writing anything, but especially this book, was write it for yourself. And then you can work on, you know, meeting people halfway. And that's kind of what I eventually settled on as my, you know, inspiration too.
If we look at coaching, then let's talk a little bit about the coaching perspective and the USA, and it's probably not so well understood over this side of the Atlantic of the football culture in the USA. And so how is football coaching and the game, I guess, itself perceived in the USA at the moment? And football obviously competes with so many other big sports for attention, particularly, well, not just adults, but young players too. I mean, your book talks a bit about embracing the lifestyle of soccer, and that's something I think the US soccer football culture has really done quite well, or at least it appears that way to me as an outside observer. You know, there's big fans group, banners, chants and all that kind of thing, which you don't really see in that way at all in the other big American sports. You know, there's groups like the American Outlaws for the national team and so on, like big fan culture. Do aspects like this and the culture around the game, do they make it more appealing to I guess, a certain cross-section of American society? And how is soccer coaching perceived now compared to how it may have been in the past?
So when I was growing up, most of my coaches never played the game. They were, you know, gridiron football, baseball, basketball coaches, track and field coaches that had volunteered to be a coach for us. Or maybe they did play a little bit, but they didn't have any support because the infrastructure of the game was in development. Coaching education is still kind of elusive. I think now the game is as popular as it's ever been. It's still the highest registered number of youth players in this country, or soccer players. Coaching education is still one of those things that I would love to see improve. I mean, the methods and the actual dynamics of the coaching courses are fine, but the accessibility of it is something we're working on in this country compared to UEFA, how many qualified coaches are in Germany or Spain, for instance. We still don't have enough here. I think in terms of the culture about people going to cross sections of stadiums and in different games, I think American culture has always been a sporting culture, and we've always embraced the pageantry and the spectacle of going to games or seeing games on television. I think this is a unique opportunity for the current generation and maybe future generations to have a bunch of coaches who are out there working and writing and educating, who actually played the game at a reasonably high level and were educated by people who played abroad. And so, for instance, some of my best coaches were either very eager, lifelong learners who never played the game, or they were former players from Great Britain or from Spain or South America that came over and shared their knowledge. And so I think, you know, the generation that is playing now, younger kids now, they are in a unique time where they could really change the way the American game is perceived abroad. I still think we have a long way to go before it's the type of culture that you see other places. And, you know, I think that we have such a multitude of other sports that do compete for fandom. I do think that the product on the field in Major League Soccer, although improving, is still, there's still a viable gap between that and some of the top leagues around the world that I don't think is bridged anytime soon. And that's okay. I mean, I don't think this is about who's better and what. I think the popularity is there. The pageantry is there. The support is there. When it comes to the actual on the boots on the ground dynamics of the American player, we have outliers that are very good, but they went to Europe early. They grew up with a father who played professionally, or, you know, it's very much in this book is about the system in this country as I see it, as I experienced it. And a lot of the players that do make it despite the system, not because of it. And that's kind of the indictment of the American game. There is a culture gap. There is a lack of quality coaching across all levels of accessibility. And so I'd say if you look at it from a dichotomy of it, yes, it's very good, popular, supported, people are loving going to games. We're still working our way up into the, if you look past the behind the curtain, so to speak, we still have a lot of work to do. And it doesn't mean it's all bad, but I think every system needs to be questioned and examined and looked at through a critical lens, because that's part of what top footballing nations have done. They've not been afraid to, you know, look at alternative ways to maybe shift the culture and the dynamic of their game.
I mean, your book talks a bit, the cover of it talks a bit about the embracing the lifestyle and how that's a sort of recurring theme. How important do you think doing that, embracing that the lifestyle of the game, is in sort of hooking people in when they're young, I guess, and leading into developing them as a player? Do you think it, you know, is it a crucial thing that actually leads to, I don't know, a better playing experience, a better coaching experience at a young age?
I believe it does. I think I was very lucky as a kid to not be exposed to Little League baseball or TV football. I was playing soccer because I grew up in a community that had a lot of immigrants. And it was just I grew up in California, so we had 365 days of sunshine. And so it was accessible to me. And so I learned and I saw that a lot of my friends' fathers could play at, you know, any given time. And they was part of what they loved. When they went to the bus stop, they had a ball in their hands or their foot. And we found plenty of ways to play the game that weren't conventional. And in American society, and maybe it's the same in other countries, is very hyper-organized for young kids now. Everyone's scheduled, overscheduled. They're going from activity to activity. And I think sometimes kids see the games as a chore. It's an activity that they've been carted off to go do. They don't go seek it out. And for me growing up, it was great to not have social media, great to not have instructions. It's just, you went outside to play. And I think what we are seeing now is, at least in my country, kids need to be doing a lot more. It could be any sport, but they need to be expressing themselves through sport and through activity in a healthy, safe way. But also, it should be an extension of what their passion is. I think sometimes you look at a kid and you say, hey, do you want to go play outside? And they're like, okay, yeah, you know, I mean, I they want to put down the controller or their phone. And so the lifestyle thing, when I went to Europe, one of the things I noticed is when kids weren't playing with their teams, they were still finding a way to consume the game, whether it's watching it, talking about it, playing in the street, playing on court. And I saw that where I was growing up, but when I went other places, and, you know, that was just my neighborhood, but when I went to other neighborhoods, you could see a pristine pitch and there's no one playing on it. And you would never see that in Europe. You see kids out there all the time. So I always felt that embracing it as a lifestyle helped you develop an identity, helped you develop some passion for it, and also helped you develop a yearning to, not just get better, but to enjoy every time you go out and kick a ball. I think that's one of the things that we sometimes can coach out of players. And this is currently from a coaching perspective, but it's very easy to take a young kid who shows promise and go overboard with it too. So, not every time you play has to be with a coach, and not every time you have to play it should be about development. It should just be about enjoyment as well. And one of the best stories I have about this is when I was talking to a friend of mine from Brazil. He said, we wouldn't get like thousands of touches on the ball in practice. We would just jog with the ball to the beach and play there for 3 or 4 hours and jog back. We're touching the ball every step. So we got our touches in too. And it was just like you did. It's not necessarily a rigid thing. It's just that's how they express themselves. That's how they, it's a common language. I guess last point is in my life, there's been many times where I didn't speak the same language as the guys on the field, but we had a common understanding on the field because we love the game. So that's kind of where I think that lifestyle blending with sport can be very, very beneficial.
All right, Gary, come to you on this one. It's obviously the points John's touching on there. It's quite interesting in terms of how the contrast from John's country to ours and Spain too, in your case, where, as John's saying there, and from the Netherlands, kids with a ball is the first thing they think to do. But is it possibly, as we go forward, more competing interests than maybe there were before, that some of what John's talking there from the differing sports and activities in America, but increasingly, I guess, here, kids are more interested in maybe it's still consuming football, but consuming it in electronic sports rather than going out and doing it. I guess the competing interest, it's still a consideration for a country where football is their number one sport.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I remember when I was a school kid, I'm going back 55 years or so now, and when we got home from school or we were in the summer holidays, you got the ball out and you played football. I mean, there might have been a couple of weeks in the summer when you played cricket for a bit, but, there weren't any other distractions, really. I mean, there wasn't even that much kids' TV on at the time. But now they're sort of the competing, the things competing for the kids' attention these days are much more. And you mentioned earlier the electronic consumption of football, but also, computer games and that sort of thing. And social media dictates, demands far more attention than it used to when I was young. It's going to have a massive effect, of course. Over here in Spain, it's interesting that, in England, you get football, you get rugby union, rugby league, cricket. You just don't get that competing things over here in Spain. There's football. Tennis is obviously a fairly big sport because they've got a lot of decent tennis players, but there's not that many competing team sports. So you do see kids play more. It's interesting what John was saying about, the organisation and how organized sport isn't necessarily the best way to for a young player to develop his relationship with the ball. And I probably enjoyed my time playing unorganized football with my mates more than anything, because you can try things, you can try different techniques, and it doesn't matter if it doesn't work. You might laugh at you, but you're going to get a coach giving you GBA to the Euros or a skill teacher if it costs you a game. And so I think, unorganised football with just some kids taking a ball out and playing with it, enjoying it. I think the key, as John mentioned there, is enjoying it is important. It's so important. It gives you a joy and a love of the game. And, you mentioned about having an identity with it. I think that's part of it as well.
And coming to you, Steve, and I, John also talked a bit there about embracing the culture of the game, like newer football countries. I don't want to sound disparaging in that. Obviously, USA's got a long history of football, but maybe in terms of the professional leagues and a bit the growth of fan culture and so on. This is something I witnessed in when I lived in Japan as well. These countries embracing the culture, possibly even to a greater extent than the more traditional countries. They borrow bits from what they see elsewhere and make it their own. Do they sometimes, do you think, take this to a level where it becomes even more fun than the cultures they're mirroring?
I think so, because what they do is that it's almost like you become a sponge for all sorts of different variant of the game and the way that the game is loved and supported by others. I mean, I've been to Japan as well, and what I found fascinating was that the way they supported the teams that I went to see lent more towards a South American kind of inspiration rather than a European. So, you know, it's just fascinating little kind of like nuances, and I think we all probably do it as a Liverpool supporter. I know the way we support our football team is very non-British. You know, it has little elements of Europe in there and little elements of South America and all sorts. So, you know, it's not just an American thing. You know, there are a lot of football teams that will take that inspiration of others. You know, I mean, you've got to look at the British game and how the Spanish will still call the manager the mister, and, you know, the anglicised use of certain football clubs all across the world. So, you know, I think football fans tend to be quite impressionable, and they take on the influences from many, many quarters. And whether that is a subconscious thing or a knowing thing, you know, I think you'd have to go individual to individual. I think probably more often than not, you'll find that it's probably a subconscious thing. You know, it's the unfurling of banners. It's all sorts. There's you know, a lot of inspiration is found from many, many, many different avenues.
Indeed so. I mean, it makes it all the richer, of course, the absorbing and then adding the bits of their own culture as well, just to add into the mix. But coming back onto another theme you mentioned just in that last chat, John, you talked about players being at total ease with the ball, you know, their relationship with the ball, how many touches and so on, and developing this in players. So have your experiences of Dutch football that you talked about there and Dutch coaching, have they influenced you quite heavily as a coach and in turn, I guess, influenced what you've been writing about here?
Oh, absolutely. When I first started coaching, I was about 6 months removed from playing competitively. And what was interesting was I had to really take a step back and say, okay, the players that are on the field that are listening to you, it's not necessarily what you say, it's going to be what they hear. And so how can you explain this to them? Like, whatever the case may be, they were, you know, 14 to 18-year-old kids, high school kids. And that's a diverse range of ages, even 4 years. Yeah. And I remember some of the coaching I received when I was in the Netherlands, but also I had a Dutch coach here in the U.S. And the way he spoke and the things he emphasized and the simplicity of what he was trying to convey, that's always something that stuck with me. And so there's an acronym that a coach used to tell me, which is the KISS method, which is the keep it simple, stupid method. And I remember thinking, I'm trying to implement things on the field that I only know because I've played this game my whole life. These players have never received any type of, you know, they may or may not have been over, you know, teams like I have, or they may not have played at a high level. So lots of touches on the ball, lots of, I call it linear passing methods, but anyone who's watched young Dutch teams train, they have grids, they have passing patterns, and it's very repetitive and almost rhythmic. And that's something that even a player that didn't understand what I was trying to accomplish, I'm giving them something that they could easily repeat. It didn't tire them out. They saw purpose to it. As soon as I learned how to keep it simple and give them things that once they were able to do with proficiency, their eyes opened up. Instead of saying, hey, we're going to scrimmage for, you know, 90 minutes and we're just going to play games and we're going to shoot, it was, we're going to do passing in pairs. We're going to do passing in, you know, third man running. We're going to do all these things that, not to be too overly technical or complex, but they could see that they had proficiency on the ball. They were getting the ball a lot in practice. They were not afraid to have the ball. You know, I think a lot of British and even American youth football is about a culture that is now about creativity. But when I was playing, if you lost the ball, you heard about it from 10 other players, plus the coach, plus the parents. And so you didn't want the ball sometimes. Or you had it in the back, you didn't play out of the back. You kicked it forward and that was your job. And what I wanted to introduce to my players and what I embraced as a young player was, you have the ball, be exceptional on it if you can. And it doesn't mean do tricks. It's just, you know, be comfortable in any situation. And to do that, it involved forming your relationship with the ball. And I say that phrase, and I think it can be kind of misconstrued. One of my favorite stories when I was in Holland was the coach took me to a car park and said, okay, there's a wall there, so I want you to spend 10 minutes on the wall. And then there's a curb here. Kick it against the curb, see what happens. And then bounce up to my chest. Like, now do that for 10 minutes. and then, you know, dribble for 10 minutes and just get used to all the different ways the ball moves and whatnot. But this is no different than if you're on the pitch. It's no different than if you're with your teammates. But the ball should be part of you, an extension of you. And I think that's one of the things that in American culture, and especially with Dutch soccer, there's a man that is my coaching mentor who is named Terry Mickler, and he takes teams over to Holland every year, and he's immersed in Dutch methodology. But he said to me, in the U.S., a soccer ball is not a special thing because you can go buy one anywhere. And other places, you may have one ball for 20 kids. So it's much more coveted. It's much more valued. So when you go play with your friends at the park or you go or, you know, at the training, you don't just take it for granted. And I think that's one of the things that I tried to really write about in this book was, you know, although it's just the ball, it should be an extension of your love for the game. And that's kind of where, you know, players who are eager to develop, and they can be true in basketball too. You see them, you know, dribbling the ball down the street or, you know, between classes. It's just having that familiarity, that comfort, that proficiency on the ball. And that comes in many different methods. But I learned to start going back to my own upbringing and some of the Dutch influence that I had, create a very simple method for players to build upon. And it's been very, very helpful for me just to look at the game that way.
You're talking there a little bit about coaching techniques and so on, and without getting into the depth, of course. I mean, is there a set of techniques that kind of apply across the board? Or do you have to see players in the individuals and the coaching has to be developed therefore to suit their individual needs and talents rather than just drilling, for want of a better phrase, drilling everybody in the same way? Is coaching an exact science? And you talk also in the book about the leap for a player from good to great and then to elite. And do those coaching concepts therefore get more markedly different the higher the level, or is the fundamentals still fairly consistent?
That's a good question. So one thing that I found that many coaches are guilty of, and I myself was, is you don't start building, you know, with the roof. You have to build the foundation. So houses don't get built with the roof starting. And that's one of the things that I really had to deconstruct when I wrote this book, is what makes the great players great is not necessarily the flair, it's their control and consistency. It's the comfort on the ball, it's their decision-making. And do I think coaching is an exact science? I think I would say no, but I do think that player development is completely inexact. I think that's the one thing that I really try to hit on, is there's no one way to develop an elite player. There's many different stories and inlets into the game. With coaching, though, I think one of the biggest techniques is ball work. And it doesn't mean just static, you know, getting touched on the ball. I mean, it can be, instead of making them run last without the ball, make them run with the ball. I had a coach, you know, who never played the game. He was a track and field coach. He said, we're going to run around the 400-meter track with the ball at our foot. And it was fun. It was something that, you know, was a warm-up, but it was, you know, focused on dribbling on a different surface, focused on doing it in a circular pattern, focused on, you know, doing it under a certain amount of time. It was just a different way to... But ball work is probably the one thing that is ever present. If you look at top training sessions, a lot of what you see is the same as you see in the academy setup, but it's just done quicker, with fewer touches, and with more precision. And I think the best football that you see is the simple stuff, but it's done to great effect. And some of the best teams out there that can do this, you know, you watch the way that they play. It's not necessarily about the flair. It's about individual brilliance, but also the cohesion and the... They control the game because they control the ball. And I think that's one of the things that I've always valued, is I want players and I want people to understand that coaching can be less about the X's and O's and the grids. It can be about, you know, instilling a value on something and players take it home. Because one thing that I've learned as a coach is I only have that number of hours with players each week. But if I can load them with, hey, here's some things you can do on your own, here's some things that you should pursue, and they take it and they have extra hours to do that, and then they come back to me with, hey, I tried this, I learned it, I, you know, I can see the point of it. That's really where I think a good coach and their technique kind of go. Last point, I think, when you talk about bridging gaps between, you know, different levels, the best coaches are the ones that can accommodate the players in ways that, if the system's not working, do they change the system or do they change the players? And I think you have to kind of be willing to do both. When I first started coaching, I was very rigid. This is how we play, this is, you know, and then coach told me, if that's not working, why don't you change it? You know, if what you're seeing on the pitch isn't what you see in your mind, change it. And having the courage to, you know, maybe go against what you initially thought is another way that I think coaches succeed.
It's quite an interesting contrast, I guess, to when all of us were young lads with a dream of the way coaching techniques were Certainly from what I recall, it was, you know, rather more standardized, and, you know, you have a bit of a run and then you have maybe some simple passing moves and then you play a bit of a game. I mean, Gary, I imagine it's a similar thought for you from your experiences of football training as a young lad.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, but also when I took my coaching badges, it's interesting hearing what John said about the coach techniques. I mean, I was in my sort of late 30s when I did my coaching badges. So that's I suppose 25 years ago now. And hopefully it's changed since then, because it was very sort of rigid lines and this is the technique, and relationship with the ball wasn't a big thing. And it's fascinating hearing John say about the things that he sort of picked up in the Netherlands as well. And, you know, it's important that a kid has this comfort with the ball. I mean, if you're playing football, you've got to be comfortable with the ball. You don't want to be the guy who doesn't want the ball. You don't want to be the guy who's going to hoof it because he hasn't got the confidence. And, you know, coach of an under-12 team is screaming at a kid who's terrified to touch the ball because he'd lost possession once, he cost the game. And, you know, in 2 weeks' time, nobody's going to remember who won an under-12 game. But it's important for that kid's development that he enjoys playing football. He takes that... That comfort in being in possession. And as a phrase that John mentioned a couple of minutes ago, about, you know, it's been simple, and I'm going to butcher the quote, so forgive me in advance, but John Cruyff said that the best football is simple football. Playing simple football is the most difficult thing in the world because people complicate the simple game, or words that effect. And just hearing what John said there, just would a straight echo back, you know. And to me, that's the way football should be. It's not that difficult a game. It's not that complicated a game. You know, as the title of John's book said, it's just a ball. And, you know, people should be comfortable with the ball and dribble the ball around the house or in the garden or on your way to school. Get comfortable with it. That's the essence of the game, isn't it, really?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, you're touching right there of another sort of thought that occurs to me about more rigid coaching, I guess, is that you talk there of comfort with the ball. And I'll come to you, Stephen, on this one. Do you think it's possible, we talk about getting comfortable with the ball, familiar with it, taking it everywhere, the kind of raw talent or the free spirit, if you want to use a bit of a different way of looking at it, can that be coached out of people at times? You know, they can become conformist rather than a free spirit. Use a bit of hippie phraseology there. Is that a danger, or is that something that it's on the coaches to ensure that doesn't happen?
Oh, it's definitely a thing. You know, you get so many talented kids who don't fulfill their potential. You know, it happens time and time again at youth levels. So yes, you know, and that's just a side effect of the game at the higher level. What I find quite frustrating is that you might see instances where there is a raft of talented players at youth level playing for profile clubs that fall by the wayside, but they never seem to kind of like make it further down the leagues or even kind of like the upper non-league system. Often for me, it ends up feeling like there should be some kind of happy medium. If they're deemed not good enough for the Premier League, if they're deemed not good enough for the Championship, then surely there must be a place for them somewhere. I think it's a wondrous thing that so many more, you know, British players are branching out to play the football in other countries. You know, I think that's a vital thing. You know, going back to the concept of enjoying the ball and, you know, just enjoying football is such a massive, massive part of the success of the greatest teams. Leicester have grown up as a Liverpool supporter and been able to imbibe everything about the Liverpool way, as it was always called. You know, the concept of, I remember the concept of Bill Shankly, Bob Paisley and the boot room coaches going to Lillishaw, being compelled to go to Lillishaw by the FA to take part in blackboard sessions and you know, to be taught how to coach, and eventually kind of like, you know, just losing the patience with it, and eventually kind of like taking over the sessions and the teachers of the sessions kind of like listening in awe of what the likes of Shankly and Paisley were saying. And it's exactly the same as you know, Meikles and Cruyff, you know, and Ajax, the great Ajax system, and the way Barcelona have been for the last 30 years. Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, they all adhere to it. And, you know, you can't fear the ball. You know, there has to be a joy of the ball. You know, you have to crave it. You have to want it. You know, you can't want to hide from the ball. You know, if you don't want the ball, then football's not the sport that you should be involved in. You know, I grew up as, you know, I played at school levels. I had trials at Wigan. You know, I had, and then when I went to those trials, I could, even then, back in kind of like, would have been late 80s, you know, the concept of being told how to deal with a ball, you know, given a textbook style of what you had to do, you know, rather than that kind of enjoyment of the ball. I remember walking away disillusioned at the concept of kind of like, you know, if that's the way that I'm being treated, or to teach how to play the game. And going back to coaching, you know, the great coaches, you know, do infuse, you know, you have to have the audience as well. You know, you have to have the receptive audience, and there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of variables within that. You know, at the end of the day, football coaches are teachers. They're teaching the game of football, you know, and it comes back to passion. You know, you have to impart that passion. You know, you have that willing audience to think, yes, this is the way that, you know, I buy into the way that this person's talking about football and their vision of ball, what they should be doing. And a mastery of the ball, you know, is made to sound sometimes like a science, and if you know, it's only the rights of the greatest players. It could be the right of any player to be able to enjoy the ball and to love the ball, and that's exactly what you've got to do. You've got to be able to love the ball and to be able to, I don't know, kind of control it. You know, I mean, that sounds simple, and it is that base simplicity. You know, that all great football is based on. Go back to the Hungarians. I mean, I tripped across a tweet the other day about someone's praising Pirlo's system at Juventus, that he was bigging up the system that he was playing. And I felt, rightly so to a degree, but it was the way that it was sold as being something that was revolutionary. And they put a template of the system, of the formation down. And as I looked at it, I was just looking at it thinking, well, that's kind of like the Hungarian style of play in the 1950s. You know, it's the way that it was a deep line defender push forward, but the formation was exactly what it was, what Hungary dismantled England with in 53 and 54, but done separately. You know, back then it was like the forward five and one of the five dropped back, and you know, the formation was exactly what it was. And going back to kind of like the Anderlecht match we did, and me and Stu were lucky enough to speak to Vincent Kompany, and he very tellingly came out and said that, you know, some of the way that they played the game in the 50s and the simplicity of the formation and just the basic, you know, putting it down to basics and saying, look, this is a very simple way of doing something that people think is overly technical. You know, but he was a great believer in kind of like, you know, being able to learn so much about how football was played 70 years ago and still being very, very applicable today. And this is what kind of like rang a bell when I looked at this formation and thinking, yeah, you know, it's great to play that, but this is something they were doing 70, 75 years ago. There's a concept of reinventing the wheel. My phrase with football sometimes is that you can't, there's nothing new in football. It is often something that is upcycled, recycled. You know, it's something that's been before, but it's given a contemporary tilt. And this is all, you know, for me, you know, you can learn so much on so many aspects of football, whether that's just supporting the game, being involved in the game, teaching the game, you know, whatever you can impart in the game, so much you can learn from the past that you can apply today. And so much of it translates through the decades, through the generations. And it often comes back to the simplicity of the game. And that way to impart these pearls of simple wisdom.
Talking there about learning from the past, but I guess another theme of learning is from other sports. Now, John, I mean, it's a fair truism. We all remember those kids at school who were excellent at everything, you know, brilliant footballers who are also brilliant rugby players, cricket players, or whatever other sports it may be, possibly gridiron in your case. Is there an element, therefore, in the coaching that can benefit people in other sports? I guess both in both directions, you know, a strong football background, does that benefit kids who then choose a different sport? And also vice versa. And I guess that's particularly notable possibly in America, where, you know, the coaching in the other big sports is, I imagine, very strong and very well well sort of considered and well planned out. Is, I mean, do people come to football late with a set of attributes that they've learned through other sports that actually benefit them quite strongly in football?
So when I first started playing the game and then coaching the game, it's kind of an interesting thing, because some of the best coaches I had were, they were very good coaches and very good teachers. And when I started coaching and studying different ways to, whether it was motivate or reach players or even organize myself, I was looking to every single sport for some type of inspiration or learning outlet. And one thing that I think is very, very dangerous for some players and some parents even, is to specialize early in the sport. So even if you're a player, like, you know, I had friends that were excellent at everything they played, and then they almost could pick whatever sport they wanted and they would have been successful. And I also had friends that never showed any promise, and then I don't talk to them for a while, and they show up one season and they're brilliant. I think one of the things that is interesting about cross sport disciplines and exposure to these different sports is there's so much that goes into being a good player, and there's so much that goes into playing the game in a dynamic way. And so one thing that I've always appreciated was there's the physical side of things, and then there's like the compete level and the mental side, and there's the emotional side. And I think each sport will challenge these things in a different way. And so the best players that I've ever played with and against had coaches that were embracing a multitude of different activities. So one great coach that I had was a phenomenal wrestling coach. And a lot of our sessions, when we weren't doing well as a team, we're not necessarily soccer based or football based, they were team building sessions. So he would make us do things like carry one another on our back and then dribble a ball with that, or do very combative things, one-on-ones the whole time, and just kind of get used to losing possession, regaining possession, stuff like that. That if you look at a structured football coaching session, that may not be an activity that would pass you in a coaching badges course. You know, they probably would boost you. But, you know, here's something where he wanted us to get much better in one-on-one situations, because that was where we were losing games. And so I said, we're going to do one-on-ones the entire session. And, you know, there were also coaches that I had that were phenomenal running coaches, and they would say, well, how can we make the best of this? Instead of making your own sprints, maybe we'll do, you know, activities with the ball that involve running, or maybe we'll take running out of the realm of punishment and make it as an enabling aspect of your session. And so I had a great coach who never played the game, but he would give us running workouts to do on our own. That if you do these and you come to the session, we'll never run again. If you do it on your own, we can do team and tactics and technical stuff on my time. And that was really beneficial in terms of having coaches extend their efforts and abilities across sport. I also had a very good music teacher who, you know, talked about learning how to play scales. And what does that really show you in terms of, you know, being comfortable in front of a crowd? And, you know, how can you rehearse things in such a way where they become part of your identity, I guess, as an artist or as a player? And so one good anecdote from the book is I went and watched a professional, like, NFL team practice or an NBA team. If you ever go to a game before the whistle blows, you see players do the simplest things just almost in their sleep, but it kind of builds in that, you know, the simple stuff done well, done right every time is why they're at the level they're at. And I would say most good coaches, good players had a varying degree of influence on their own upbringing. And I think every player's story is unique, and their repertoire of skill and their arsenal of tools is very much not just one sport and one coach and one method getting them there. And again, I think the other end of this too is the game is probably one of the best teachers you can have. And that's where we get back to that organic, unstructured free play. That's really important. I mean, there's so many lessons that I learned that were never coached into me that I couldn't coach to my players now. They have to experience that. And a lot of that is the hard lessons in life and in the game. And I think try to speak to that a lot in the book as well.
Oh, Gary, coming to you on this theme, and we see sort of specialisms or greater focus on, I guess, the finite details coming far more into football at the elite level. Certainly, you know, Liverpool had a throw-in coach recently, things like that. You know, do you think more attention being paid to each aspect of the game? You know, if you want to coin a cycling phrase here, the marginal gains. Is this something that football has picked up from other sports, or do you think it's just a natural progression of always trying to seek the extra bit of advantage?
I think it's a bit of both, but certainly a chunk of the latter, because you know, with the advent of, you know, technology and players, individual players being videoed and watched, and how good they are, and the things they do, and the things they don't do very well. I think, you know, it is a natural progression. I'm sure it can become more and more the case. And I think, you know, at the elite level, you know, you talked earlier about the elite level. At the elite level, that's, you know, that's all well and good. But I think when you're talking about, and I mean, obviously don't do that much analysis of kids playing football, but there is that sort of pressure on them to win games and beat a school game, a youth club game or whatever. And I'm not sure that helps over much. And, you know, I mean, you mentioned the throw-in coach at Liverpool, and they were often derided from that. But, you know, the success they had last season probably put that to rest, and a lot of other clubs have taken that, taken coaches to for that now as well. So yeah, I think at the elite level, you know, the more even things become, the more that these marginal differences will, you know, can separate, you know, winning a title or not winning a title. But it's, I think, you know, the key to me is, you know, John talked about the young players, the coaches, you know, they're going to enjoy it. And I think if you're not, you know, it's, as I said earlier, it's a simple game. And John mentioned, you can't get too technical. You can't get, you know, if a player puts his foot over one slightly on a throw in, you're going to send him back to do 14 times to learn it. You know, just tell the guy and let him play, because it's all about enjoyment at that sort of age.
Well, indeed. So, but we talk a bit more about development in the USA, John. Obviously, you know, in terms of international success, the women's team has had far more than the men's. I guess it's, you know, the relative levels that they've achieved, it's, you know, it's a different level altogether what the women's team has been able to do. Does this reinforce any sort of pre-held gender biases about football in America, or is this something that can benefit the game as a whole across the genders and get more people involved, no matter what gender they are?
You know, growing up, it was having the opportunity to go to a couple different countries, but I'll talk about the Netherlands again. Up until age like 12, 14, most games we played against girls, boys, and mixed in sessions. And it wasn't physically or technically any drop off. At a certain point, you know, the genders do differ greatly. And you know, the difference between a 14-year-old boy and a 16, 17-year-old boy are massive. But growing up and seeing that, and even coming back home and not seeing that was really interesting to me. My sister was both my sisters who were really good. I have three sisters. One was a very good tennis player, and the other two were very, very good soccer players. And they all had their own unique abilities, and they were always playing with boys. It was really just one of these things. And in terms of the women's success in this game, even at the collegiate level, the national team, they've definitely reached heights that the men can only aspire to reach. I would like to think that they've served as inspiration for anybody who enjoys the game to want to enjoy it, but also pursue it. And I also think that growing up for me in you know, I'm 36 now, it hasn't been that long where soccer has been an accepted sport in terms of popularity, in terms of, you know, players that I have now, they aspire to be professional. I never had that dream. I had a dream, but I never said to anybody. And that was one of those things, because it was like, oh, you want to play soccer? Like, what? I mean, it was very, very looked down on, because it wasn't considered a tough sport. It wasn't considered a sport that was American. And I think one of the things that I'm hoping with the success of the women, and even though the women's game, that gap is being bridged by other countries, I'm hoping that that'll still raise all the ships as that tide raises for everybody. So, you know, to answer your question, I think the attitudes have changed over the years. I think the women's game has set an example of what can be achieved if you, you know, really dedicate resources and give opportunities to enough players. I think what we're going to see with the men's game is the big misconception in the U.S. is, well, we're getting better. We should be able to compete with everyone else. And I always say, well, they're not stopping their development either. It's not like they're going to wait for us. It's going to be, the game is ever evolving. If you look at countries that had radical improvements, Germany, Spain, Belgium, they fast-tracked their development system, but they still had that culture. They still had a lot of that underlying foundational stuff. And I think in this country, we need to realize, and I think England's a great example as well. I think there's a promising generation of young British players, the players that are doing the business. I think one thing that we start to see is it might take a couple good tournaments. It might take a good World Cup run, but really, the more you can open up access to the game across genders, across levels, across socioeconomic barriers, the better it is for everybody. The better it is for the sport, for the culture, for the society. And again, I think it's a long shot to say that we're ever going to win a World Cup. But I think it also, that shouldn't be the goal. It should be, the goal should be to continue to develop, benefit development on both sides of the spectrum.
It's quite an interesting contrast, Stephen, isn't it, to our country, of course, in many ways, in terms of, the strength of the women's game versus the men's. Here, obviously, there's been decades of it being banned before the progress that's now become much more rapid, of course. But, the US, the women's game in over recent decades has been far stronger than the men's, as John's saying. It's quite an interesting contrast in terms of development and engagement and all of those aspects, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. When I was writing my Dutch book, I spoke to a journalist in the Netherlands, and he was telling me that after the Dutch women's team won the European Championship, there were lads playing in Dutch shirts with Vivian Miedema's name on the back, the lad who plays for Arsenal. So you've got lads playing with a woman's player's name on the back of their shirts. So there is that sort of, certainly in the Netherlands there was this cross-pollination, shall we say, between, the men's game and the women's game. And it didn't seem to be it wasn't a barrier. I mean, I think, I just fascinated me, John, talk about the development of the game in the USA. And, and we often, I know we've had conversations on parts of the past about, one day America, because of their massive population, their sporting culture will produce, a world-class team. But as John says, the rest of the world, it's going to stand still and wait for them to catch up. So, it will be. It might take a while for them to catch up. The progression as you get better and better will be slower, and therefore, I'm sure the Americans will catch up. But it's fascinating to hear that, John said that, it's not going to be as easy as some people think it is. But, to go back to the women's game in America, the women's national team in the USA, I mean, they're far and away the best team in the world by a country mile. And, I don't know. Or not. We had Steve and myself interviewed Lindsay Hooper. John won't know, but she's a journalist over here. She works on the women's football, but also on men's football as well. And she was saying that, how far the English game's gone. And when I said to her, about why are the American women's teams so good, she said, well, I don't really know. There's not really a clear answer. And if there was the clear answer, then obviously other countries would be doing it. But it's a fascinating contrast between the women's game and the men's game in different countries. And as you say, in Britain, women's football was subdued, and banned for an extent as well. But now it's sort of galloping on quite a bit. And, I think Chelsea have got to the semi-finals of the Champions League this season. I think the women's game and the men's game it shouldn't really be seen as different games any more than other sports where men and women, both play, be it tennis or whatever. It's the same game. There are physical differences in approach, but it's the same game.
Yeah, Stephen, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I'd suggest that America's had the great advantage there of the women's game's not started at a massive disadvantage in comparison to the men's game. In so many traditional football playing nations, the women's game has had to play this horrendous game of catch up, you know, at such a massive disadvantage, way, you know, light years behind in terms of infrastructure, organization, financial input. And, you know, it has been a defined, you know, line drawn, you know, there's the lesser against the upper, and that's horrendous to have to say, but it's been very, very true. Gary mentioned the fact that, you know, it was almost an outlawed arm of the sport in the UK. You know, women were not allowed to play on football league grounds until the early 1970s. You know, it was a blossoming game 100 years ago. And it was killed off. It was strangulated, and it's never recovered over here. You know, it's one of the biggest, you know, black marks against the English game. It's the British game. Other nations, you know, progress much quicker. You know, they remedied these facts, and you know, Norway was another one. Germany have done quite well at women's levels, and I think the great thing for America is that, you know, women's football started, you know, pretty much they came out the same blocks as the men's game in so many ways. I think that's probably where it's at. You know, the mismanagement of the men's game in America, which John has pointed out so many times, so eloquently. You know, the league structures, the men's team, and you know, the way the women's game has been, it's been harvested. It's been nurtured has been nurtured in a much more intelligent way than the men's game has in America, and the women's game has been, you know, has benefited from that, and that's why it's become almost kind of like how Serie A was. You know, it's the women's game Serie A as was. You know, I always say the men's game, you know, the greatest era of any epoch of the men's game has been like the 1980s and 1990s Serie A, you know, and you know, I think time will look back and say that football in the US for the women's game at this point in time will be the yardstick, the benchmark of which all others will be measured.
It's interesting to talk of obviously the contrast there. I guess one country where I see similarities in terms of the women's game versus the men's is China. You know, I think historically, you know, over the last few decades, I think China is probably similar to America in many ways, in that the women's game has been far stronger. You know, they've got a fairly strong World Cup history in the women's game. There's also the similarities in terms of the potential and the resource of the game in both women's and men's, of course, that America has, but equally, I guess, in the historic strength of the women's game in World Cups and so on. But we'll see how it develops there. But looking ahead, we'll go back to World Cup theme, but back to the men's now. 2026, John, the World Cup is going to be in your country, as well as Canada and Mexico, of course. Now, it's still 5 years away, but that's a fair bit of time for development. But I guess that, you know, the players who will be featuring there, you know, they'll have had all of their core development by now already. You know, they may still be teenagers who are going to break through, but, you know, a lot of that development has happened already. Given the national team's success, relatively so, in 1994, a bit of a big breakthrough, certainly for the game in America and leading on to MLS and so on. How optimistic are American aspirations for 2026, realistically or you know, dreamland?
Depends on who you ask, but the benefit will be, I'll talk about the benefits first. We won't have to qualify, which I think is going to happen. I think qualifying out of CONCACAF is unique in ways that I don't think people who have never been to a game in Central America or Mexico City at altitude, or even someplace in the U.S. that's unrealistically hot or cold, and can really attest to experiencing. But our failure to qualify for the last World Cup, our failure to qualify for the last three Olympic cycles has been kind of a glaring thing. And my hope is that by 2026, we were competitive enough to not put all of our eggs in one basket with a giant hole at the bottom. What I mean by this is U.S. soccer is notorious for setting grand goals, and it's great to have great goal setting, but there's a thing out there called the Project 2010 project, and it's basically U.S. soccer's goal to win a World Cup by 2010, and that obviously didn't happen. It didn't work. Carlos Queiroz is one of the authors of that plan, and and it's a failure to launch in a lot of ways. So I think in terms of looking at what 2026 can do for the game in this country, there's two things that I really think are important. One is continue to build the culture, the infrastructure, the core identity of the game, the global game, not just the American game, as all these great teams come to North American soil. I think that's a really, really big celebration of the game. I think it's going to be good for everybody. In terms of what's on the field and how, what we've produced some fantastic young players now, and hopefully by 2026, they're sharp enough to, you know, be competitive and have a good showing at a tournament. Historically, U.S. teams on the men's side don't do well in tournament football. It's just something that the Germans haven't figured out. It's like, you know, they could play the ugliest style ever, but they somehow advance and whatnot. There's always a lot of quips about that. But without that, that's important is we haven't qualified for the Olympics for the third time running. And that's an important tournament for that under 23 age group. That's a, it's another tournament where they play international teams, albeit different rules. It's another tournament where you can test yourself against other countries and foreign lands. And I think there's a lot at stake there. And we failed to qualify for that now. And so it's really one of these things where it could go either way. It could be really good. We could figure it out in 5 years to sort it, or it could be a repeat of, you know, the failure to qualify in 2018. You know, that's also possible. And so obviously we'll be there at the tournament, but if I was looking at 2022, what was going to happen there? There's a lot of question marks there. So I think a lot of the success is going to depend on the next World Cup. And then the one we host will be obviously commercially successful, I'm sure. And it'll be, you know, it'll hook a lot of fans like 94 did. I was 10 years old at that time and I was already playing, but it was unlike anything I've ever seen. I remember writing in the book, I watched Brazil practice with Romario, Ronaldo, you know, Bebeto, and just seeing them at a field that my father played in collegiately was incredible. To see them just there in my neighborhood on post, and they would go on to win that World Cup. But it was just incredible to see them in, you know, and that for me as a young kid was amazing. I can imagine what it would be for the next generation of young kids to see players here and have the opportunity to see them play in stadiums that, you know, are located in our country in Canada and Mexico.
And Gary, Steve, I'll give you both a chance to give your thoughts on American aspirations for 2026 and what it may do for the game in America.
Well, I think I'm correct in saying that 1994 was the best attended World Cup of all time. So you know that speaks of something. I think the USA is probably the last great country not to have a competitive football team in world tournaments, and it would be a great thing for world football if, as and when, the USA does get to that sort of level. You know, and you know, as I referred to earlier, John said that, you know, perhaps, you know, this isn't going to be as easy as some people think it is, but you know, the Americans are making progress, and you know, 2026 is 5 years away, and they will be better than they were in 94. They were better than they are today, and I don't know how far away they are. And you know, I mean, I think they're a long way from being in Brazil. You know, they're a long way from being, you know, the team's going to win the World Cup. But to be competitive, to get to the, you know, the quarterfinals or perhaps semi-final, you know, I mean, it would be great. It'd be great for world football, I think, and that's the key. And you know, success would also be great for the development of American football. So you know, fingers crossed that they will put on a great show. There's no doubt about that. But it'd be great if the team, you know, puts on a great showing as well, shall we say.
Stephen?
Yeah, I think it's like John says, that 10-year-old speaking there and being able to see Romario and the Brazilian side, and you know, so upfront and personal, and so you know, as if to be able to reach out and touch them. I think that experience is all, you know, as comparable, if not more important, than the national team actually faring well within the tournament itself. Yes, you know, they need to go a distance. You know, in 94, when they made it to the last 16 and gave Brazil a game, you know, that was huge for them. You know, you look at the state of the American game at that point in time. You know, for all of its faults, it's a different. It's, you know, they've come a long way. You know, they've come a distance at least. And what you'd have to look at there is that what 2026 can do, which will be a huge World Cup, because, you know, there's so much uncertainty about next year's World Cup and where we'll be pandemic wise. you know, who will be able to go and watch it, what state it will look in. And that's beyond the fact that there's so much controversy behind Qatar hosting the World Cup as well. I think there'll be a huge appetite globally for the 2026 World Cup. I think there'll be a national thirst for it in America as well. And I do, again, it comes down to that concept of football's role of being an impressionable magnet for people. You know, this is a, you know, going to be a catalyst call, you know, people towards the sport to take part in it, to watch it, to take a, you know, a greater interest and to fall in love with the sport again. You know, the interesting thing will be, you know, 10, 20, 30 years after the 2026 World Cup and where football in America can be. You know, if we're looking at it now from the perspective of 94, you know, it needs to travel further between 2026 and 2046 than it did between 1994 and 2014. You know, and it can do that, but, you know, it's one of the great opportunities again.
Okay, well, as we begin to wrap things up here for today, John, coming back to the book itself then, firstly, I guess, when is the book out and how can people find it? And just a reminder of the title, of course, it's Just a Ball, Exploring the Complexity of a Simple Game. So now's your promo opportunity.
So the book is out on the 20th of April, coming up here, and it can obviously be found on Amazon UK. I've had, I think, Barnes & Noble, which is a... I don't know if you have those in England, but they have it here stateside, the bookstore that's pretty well known. Obviously, I have to thank Benny and Tierney for publishing the book and being patient with me this whole time. But the book will be available. It's available right now for pre-order. I think it's in Kindle and you know, print. And then, it's one of these things where as the date approaches for people to get to buy it, I'm interested to see how people receive it. But I'm also very just proud to have started something and they have questions that come out of it and they go off and, you know, it takes them to a place where they most enjoyed the game when they were younger, or even now as they have, you know, their own children or their own teams. And even if you don't play, even if you're not a coach, you're a fan, it's written for you as well. I make a big point to say that this book is about my experience and my studies in the game, but it's really written for the reader because I think a lot of us tend to read books about the best of the best, and that can seem like an alien world. And this is every man's tale of development. And I think that's an important thing.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I guess the next question, a big one, is, well, now you've got this one out, and I guess by the time people hear this, it will be out. So what are you going to follow it up with then, John? What is your second book going to be about, if indeed there's going to be one?
So I was talking to my wife earlier today, and, you know, one of her friends came over and asked, you know, how long have you been writing this book? How long did it take? And I said, if this book were going in, I'll take the American school system here. If it were being a freshman in high school when I started it, it's now graduated university looking for his first job. That's how long it took me. And that's because of life. I had, you know, two children and, you know, some other things happened in life. And I had a lot of, you know, what we call writer's block. And some of the things through the test of time. And I think that taught me a great lesson about how to write a book. I think the next book I do write, I'm committing to writing another book. It's a toss-up between a collection of essays that are related to the game that I think are really important. Some of that I've already kind of drafted. And then another idea that I have is getting what I call a field manual for players. So it's got short but consumable pieces of motivation or lessons learned that they can consume either before a training session and reflection of, you know, a game or just on the drive home or whatnot. And it's for, you know, it doesn't have to be for players, it's for parents and coaches as well. So I have two ideas that are kind of out there. And I'm sure I'll have to back up what I've written in this book in the future with some further words. So we'll see. But I do plan to write another one, and I think it's going to be a much quicker process the second time around, famous last words, but we'll see.
Oh, that's great news then. But I'm sure this first book will be absolutely superb, having read various things you've written over the years, John. So I'm quite certain it will be a thoroughly excellent read on a really, really interesting topic. So I would encourage everybody to go and purchase a copy wherever they can get hold of it. But we will wrap things up there for today then. So thank you guys for another great discussion. Gary, really, really interesting topic today, wasn't it?
Absolutely, Mike. And I'll say it's very different to the type of books we've sort of discussed in the Centre Circle before, but, you know, more fascinating because of that. And, you know, as you say, John's an excellent writer, and he's the way he writes is very readable, easy to digest and understand. So, yeah, this is going to be a cracking book for football people of all shapes and sizes and descriptions.
Absolutely. And Stephen, thank you to you too. As Gary says, you know, it's bound to be an excellent read, this one, isn't it?
Oh, without a doubt, absolute guarantee. Just get out there and buy it.
Couldn't have put it better. So, John, thanks as well. So just to repeat there, the book, It's Just a Ball, out on the 20th of April. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about it, John. Been a real treat.
I appreciate the opportunity, gentlemen. Thank you so much.
Not at all. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.